So this week, I spent some time trying to track down the origin of a quote. I had trouble with it. It seems like it's just one of those ancient proverbs that everyone seems to say came from somewhere, but everyone disagrees on who. So I've got Abraham Lincoln, JFK, Maya Angelou, even Aristotle, all attributed as coming up with the idea that to know where you're going, you must know where you're from. Have you ever heard a phrase like that before? It's got all sorts of different versions of it. Like, if you don't know where you've been, you can't know where you're going. You have to know the past in order to get to the future. Things like that. That sort of phrase. It's a decent phrase. I think it's true in a lot of circumstances. I don't know if it's always true. But at least for the case of Christmas time, I'm very confident that it's true. At least that's what Matthew thought in his gospel. You know the four gospels that share the life, the birth story, most of them, the birth story, the life, the miracles, the teachings, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Matthew is the one who seems to say that you can't know where you're going with Jesus, though, unless you know where you're from and what's going on. I think you can appreciate Jesus without knowing the Old Testament, but it really helps you appreciate Jesus if you do know the Old Testament. And that's why Matthew starts out his gospel, I think, the way he does. As we approach Christmas time, this time where we celebrate the birth of Jesus, we're going to spend today at least looking at it the way that Matthew approached it, with one of the most exciting passages in the entire Bible that most people, when they're honest, they skim either really, really, really fast or they don't read it until they see that this section is over sometimes. Maybe not most people, but I'm willing to think some here. Because it's really important to Matthew, though, and so we're going to take a look at Matthew chapter 1 and the first part of it and what is in there today. Because Matthew does not get to the Christmas story until he's done covering this material that we're going to cover today. All four gospel writers do it a little bit differently. Like Mark's gospel hits the ground running. Because if you read Mark's gospel, within one paragraph, Jesus already has his disciples, he's already performing miracles, and he's already going where he's going. Like, within a paragraph. Jesus is already a full-grown man doing miracles, has his disciples. Let's start teaching now. Let's go. If you read Luke's gospel, it starts with a musical. Like, literally. We talked about that last Christmas time, I think. The musical of the first couple chapters of Luke, every scene ends with a song. And it's sometimes we ignore that when we're reading it and we make it boring. But no, people broke out into song over how excited they were that the Messiah was coming. Every single scene has that. And then Luke has a genealogy and then goes into the story of Jesus' life as an adult. John's gospel starts the coolest way, I think, because it's the one that's like, yeah, you know, like the manger scene. Well, Jesus was there when creation was made. Like that's the John's opening of the gospel. Matthew's gospel opens up with a list of names. It's so exciting to read sometimes. But no, it is exciting when you actually pay attention to it. And that's how Matthew starts his gospel, with a list of names. Because I think Matthew actually understands that to understand what's going on with Jesus and where the gospel is going to be taking us and what it all really means, you kind of have to know out of which it's coming from and what borns this concept here. Genealogies are what they're called. Genealogies, though, what's important to note about them is a genealogy was not written to just tell someone's DNA. That was not the point of a genealogy. A genealogy was written to say whose family this person is from. Like, have you ever asked someone who their dad is to figure out who they are? Like, in smaller towns that happens sometimes, who's your family? Who are you related to? Okay, now I can know whether or not I trust you. Like, people from larger towns like me really don't like that kind of mentality, but it happens in smaller towns sometimes, right? And so it's this, okay, who are you related to? Oh, yeah, I know your dad. I did such and such with him. Okay, I'll be friendly with you. Like, it's that kind of thing. Or, like, if I was to introduce you to, if I was meeting you for the first time, I said, my name's Adam, my dad's name is Dan. That's one way to say it. What if I said, my name's Adam, my dad is Dan, he's a graduate from the University of Missouri of Science and Technology, and he works in the Boeing company as an associate technical fellow. Then that's a different way of introducing myself, right? Like, I'm not just saying, oh yeah, my dad's name happens to be Daniel. I'm saying, hey, I've actually got some roots here in Rolla, and my dad is an engineer, and he has this kind of mindset too. Like, so there's a difference in the two ways of introducing myself. Does that make sense? That's how a genealogy works. A genealogy is saying, this is his family, this is what he's coming from, this is what this is all about. That's the idea behind a genealogy. It's not just, oh, this was Jesus' dad. And actually, that's an interesting part too, as we'll see as we get into this. So let's just jump in and look at Matthew chapter 1. I'm going to start in verse 1. I'm going to read through verse 17. I'm not going to call on you to read because some of you might have a panic attack because the names. And if I mess one up, It's just because I'm in front of people while reading it. I read this 50 times this week. So let's do this. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nashon, and Nashon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Joram, and Joram the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah the father of Jotham, and Jotham the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh the father of Amos, and Amos the father of Josiah, and Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers, at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation of Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, and Abiud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Eliud, and Eliud the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar the father of Mathan, and Mathan the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. Whew, I made it. All right, thank you. This actually is a song. It's by an artist named Andrew Peterson. It's called Matthew's Begots, and so I do have this genealogy memorized because I've learned the song, and it's just played with a... I thought about making Craig play the guitar while I sang it this morning, but then I said no. Maybe.
With those glasses.
We could work something out. Like, as long as it gets auto-tuned at some point. But no, so that is, it's the list of names there. It's this genealogy of Jesus as recorded by Matthew, and it lists off 14 generations in this section, 14 generations here, 14 generations in this section, and it's just this list of names. Now, it's important to note, though, that the word genealogy at the very beginning where it says this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the word genealogy doesn't have to mean genealogy. It just means the word origins. Does that make sense that genealogy and origins are the same sort of thing? And that is only important, I think, because of a couple phrases way back in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, which chapter 1 of Genesis is the creation account in 7 days. Chapter 2, starting in verse 4, is the creation account, the really fast version of how God created the world, and then the elaborate creation account of how God created mankind. And then you get to Genesis chapter 5, and Genesis chapter 5, verse 1, starts with a similar phrase, but it is this list of genealogy of the first people of earth, and eventually getting to the creation of God's special people here. And this is, my eyes glazed over as I was trying to write out how to explain this, but our English Bibles translate from the Hebrew Old Testament. Genesis was a book originally written in Hebrew. The people during Jesus' day, though, were not reading Genesis out of Hebrew, for the most part. They were reading Genesis' translation into Greek. The New Testament was also written in Greek. So, New Testament's Greek, the author, Matthew, as he's writing this gospel, writes in Greek. All of his audience would have known Genesis in Greek. And he uses the exact same phrase as the Greek version of Genesis when it's in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, and Genesis chapter 5, verse 1. So when Matthew says, this is the origin, the book of Jesus, Genesis chapter 2 begins with, this is the book of the origin of heaven and earth, and Genesis 5 begins with, this is the book of the origin of human beings. Exact same language when Matthew writes his gospel, says this is the book of the origin of Jesus Christ. Do you think he did that on purpose? I think so. So if Matthew starts his gospel off the exact same way that the creation of humankind starts off, and the creation of, or the list of the genealogy of the first humans on earth starts off, do you think Jesus, or Matthew's saying that this genealogy about Jesus is on par, or at least close to this sort of thing? Or maybe he's saying it's better and more important? I think he's saying you're supposed to get reminded, and all of his audience would have been reminded of Genesis chapter 2 and Genesis chapter 5 when they heard that phrase, because they heard these passages read aloud a lot. And so they would have gone, you're not reading Genesis. You're telling me a different genealogy. And so they would have immediately thought of that sort of thing here. And so it's Matthew's way of saying, pay attention. This stuff's important. It's on par with God's creation. It's on par with the creation of God's special people. And so listen up. And if that doesn't perk up the listener's ears, the very first end of that first sentence says that this person's kind of important. It said, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And that would have made everyone and their ears perk up. Because once you start talking about David, it is a big deal. This isn't just some guy named Jesus that we're recording his genealogy of. This is the son of David. Now, there were lots of son of Davids technically, right? Because this genealogy tree branched out and there's lots of people named David. But why would you point someone out as being the son of David if not to make a special case here? And that's what was going on too. He also says that Jesus is the Christ here. What does the Christ mean? Does anyone know? The Christ means the anointed one. It can mean the promised one. It means specifically anointing. But it means this person who's set aside for a specific task. So he's set aside for a specific task as the son of David. Is that a big deal? Yes, as we will see, as we'll talk about this. With that established, Matthew then wants to make sure no one questions the credentials that he just said Jesus is the son of David, and so he proves that he's literally the son of David, at least in this genealogical way. So he lists the family history of Jesus here. He provides 14 generations from Abraham to David, the king. He provides 14 generations from David to the deportation into Babylon. He provides 14 generations from the deportation into Babylon to the time of Jesus. Here's the thing, though. Those weren't each 14 generations long. They weren't. The first 14 span is 1,000 years. The second span of 14 generations is 600 years. And the third span of generations is 400 years. That's odd, right? So was Matthew wrong? Because we actually, if you compare this genealogy to Old Testament genealogies and put the lists next to each other, Matthew skips people. Like, it's point blank clear that one of these two people has a list that doesn't match up. Like, the lists are not even here. But here's the deal. It's not that he was wrong. It was standard practice to skip genealogies, especially if there's a person in the tree that you just didn't care about for the story. So actually, the translation of the word is not, we put father because that just makes easier reading. It actually means begotten or, you know, person in the lineage of. And so it's grandfather, great-grandfather, in some cases, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And so as he writes the genealogy, he purposefully makes sure that it fits 14 generations. But then the next question is, why does he care that it fits 14 generations? Nobody knows. Our best guess, though, and this is where most everyone goes, because he never actually says this is why. Our best guess, though, is numerology, as far as what biblical names, the numbering of names mean. So if you'd make the letter, this isn't a perfect correlation, but just if you want to do this sort of thing with English, you'll make the letter A verse make one, letter B equal two, the letter C equal three, the letter D equal four, but you do that with the Hebrew alphabet instead. Guess what number David's name turns out to be? 14. And so Matthew here is going, so he's the son of David, David's in his lineage. Oh, by the way, in case you haven't guessed that I care that this is the line of David yet, he's got David generations and David generations and David generations. Like, that's literally what Matthew does here, if we're right about what the 14 means, which is our best guess. And so that's probably what's going on here. He's saying, if you don't get this, what if I just fill in the name David three times? But he does record accurate genealogies, though. I mean, we can compare it with the list and it's right. It's just he skips generations, which was common practice to do back then. If you ever wished you could skip a generation or two with some of your history family trees? Well, they did that back then. It was just, that's what how they did it. I mean, how boring would this list have really been if he wouldn't have skipped a generation over 2,000 years? Yeah, I would not have stopped yet. And so he thankfully plays with the genealogy, but it's acceptable practice. He's not telling us wrong. He's not steering us wrong. He's being honest. He's not being bad. This is just, that's how they did things then. And so then you go back to, okay, why did he fill in the name David? Why does he point out this is the son of David? Why does he make sure the lineage is proven that he goes through David? Why is David such a big deal? And what? Prophecy. Yeah, many of us probably know this already, right? So King David was the best king of ancient Israel times. From after David, there really wasn't very many good ones. David wasn't perfect either, right? Like, he was really bad sometimes. But what's the difference between, like, David and King Saul? King Saul, when he was proven that he had done something wrong, he went, well, it wasn't my fault. God told me to do this. And when David gets proven wrong, he goes, can I ask for forgiveness now? That's kind of the difference. Every human does pretty terrible things. David, though, actually says sorry, which sadly is a rare trait in humanity sometimes. But David did that when he got countered and told that he was wrong. And when he was shown that he was evil, he went, oops. And he tried to make amends for various things here. And so God blessed David for his character. He made a special promise for David and says, you know what, you're king. Your throne's never going to end. It will never end, King David. And he made that promise to him. And so starting actually in the time of David, suddenly you start seeing these messianic, we call them messianic prophecies because they're about the Messiah or the Christ, the anointed, the promised one. And there's all these promises given to the household of David saying, your throne's never going to go away. Your reign will never end. You're going to actually have a perfect nation that never stops. What's the problem with that promise at first, though? What happens to the very next generation? You get Solomon, who has 1,000 wives. That's not very good for many reasons. Then the next generation down, which is included in this genealogy, is Rehoboam, and Rehoboam splits the kingdom in half. He just separates out the kingdom because he made a joke about the size of his daddy's taxes and says, my taxes are going to be way bigger. Like, that's the actual joke he made. If you can read into that, that's what the Hebrew says. And he made this inappropriate joke about his daddy and saying, I'm going to tax you guys way heavier than everyone else. And so the kingdom had a civil war because they don't like that. And so now within two generations, the kingdom is not looking like it's going to have this throne that lasts forever, is it? And just a few generations later, one half of the kingdom is completely wiped out. It's destroyed by a group of the Assyrian army who does not take prisoners. They just kill. And then we get to that time in the Babylon that we talked about in the genealogy. They go off to Babylon, and they're taken captive. They don't even have their own kings anymore. There's a couple puppet kings that appear a couple times in history, but it's very obvious and everyone knows that you're just a puppet. And everyone who actually took on those titles, everyone said, you're not really a Jew. Like, that's what was said about those kings who took over that authority position. And so this promise about David is floating around, and they're going, what's going on with that? When is it coming back? And so Matthew's first sentence, coupled with his multiple references to King David, lots of references to King David, and he's saying, you know what, that throne, that promise still exists. It's still out there. It's going to happen. And if you read through the Old Testament, time and time again, there's these reminders of God's promises to make this throne an everlasting throne. The best and most famous, I say best, they're all good, but probably the most famous one is the one we heard already once today and almost twice today. And then I'm going to read it again. So Isaiah 9, it's read a lot at Christmas time, but this is one of those promises. It says, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shone. So it's saying you're wondering where the throne is going to be. You're wondering where this promise has gone. It's dark and gloomy, but this light is shining. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, and they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. So the oppressors, the foreign governments that are keeping the Jewish people down, they're going to be broken. For every boot of the trampling warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. Wouldn't it be nice if weapons of war were just fuel? Like, that's what it's saying here. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase in his government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of who? David, and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. And so 14 generations and 14 generations and 14 generations, David generations, David generations, David generations, the son of David. He's in the lineage of the King of David. Hey, by the way, in case you don't know about David yet, he's going to be fulfilling these promises. This is a big deal, guys. That's what Matthew's saying with this genealogy here. And so God makes the Israelite people a people of faith like Abraham. That's why it started with Abraham. They're also a broken people, though, as you read through the genealogy, though. But then we get to the through that generations, we get to the second set. And so it's from David, who's the height of the promises, to the fall of Babylon, when those promises are kind of like forgotten almost. They're remembered, but they're cried out about. And then after they get freed from Babylon, the promises are just floating around there. And so these generations begin with the unusual note that David had a son. Or actually, I'm going to skip that part of my notes. Because I went way off book in here, way off script. So these sets of generations here, the first part shows that God establishes people. The second part shows God's people can't really save themselves. They're trying, they fail, and they go off to Babylon. The third generation shows that there's hope floating around here. And there's many people listed here. We don't have time to go into all the various names. I'm not going to go into all of them. You might be thankful for that. Some of them, literally, we have no other record other than the name in this list, especially as it gets closer to the time of Jesus. Why might that be the case? Why might we have no other genealogical record of a couple people? Why? Because there's 400 years before the Old Testament was finished. When the Old Testament was finished, there's 400 years to the time of Jesus. But also, like, there's no more kings. They kept good records to track who's going to be king. And now it's, oh. Like, and so we have official records from a lot of stuff until there was no reason to keep official records. Then it was just family records, and most of those have been lost to time. And so, but Matthew recorded this record for us. And so the question is, as the lineage of David literally gets morphed into obscurity, the only record we have is these verses of many of those generations. What happens to the throne of David? And now what happens to the promises of David? And so that's why this genealogy is a big deal. It is here. What was done in the past that caused the exile, that caused the splintering of God's people, that caused the diaspora, the spreading out of God's people, it will all be undone in the Messiah. And skipping generations to make a point is what he did here. He made this point of David, I think, in this. But he also did something else that's unique. So skipping generations is normal. He did something that's unique in this genealogy. Anybody have a guess as to what it is that doesn't happen in most genealogies? He includes a bunch of women, right? That was abnormal, because you're tracing the line of a king. It's not the way it should be, but this is the way it was back then. Do you need to include women? You didn't back then. She should, probably. I mean, women are not second-rate people, but that's a lot of how genealogies worked back then. That's the reality of how bad the world has been. But Matthew includes a bunch of women, though, here. And he does this good thing by including women, but also it's an interesting note about which women they are. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. The story of Tamar is one of those weird ones you don't read the children. You don't, probably. You skip a lot of details when you do. But basically, this woman is mistreated really badly mistreated. And so she takes upon herself to help herself and set herself free from this oppression she's kind of in. And she does so by playing the role of a prostitute. That's how she makes it out of the mess that she was put in. Rahab is a woman who really was a prostitute. And she's not just a prostitute. She's also a member of a Gentile nation that was an enemy of the Jewish people. Then the next woman, Ruth. Ruth is a woman who married into the Jewish people eventually, but she wasn't at the time. She was married into the Jewish people. She's originally an enemy of the Israelites, though. And like Tamar, she had to take matters into her own hands. And if you read the story, she did something that some people might have considered her acting like a prostitute. If you remember, Boaz said, don't go out until it's, like, don't let people see you. He was hiding the fact that something, people would have pointed fingers and said something inappropriate happened. And so that's why Boaz says, actually, hang on, don't make this public until we deal with a few things first. That's why Boaz did that there. Then there's Bathsheba, right? She didn't dress up or work as a prostitute or do something that someone else might have done, but David definitely treated her like a prostitute. And so we've got all this stuff happening in the lineage of Jesus that a lot of it has to do with prostitutes, which is kind of weird, right? Why would he include those women in this? Not just that, all four of them could be considered Gentile women. And not Jewish people. So they're not Israelite. We know that Bathsheba, we're not sure about her lineage, but she was at least married to a Gentile, and so there would have been a stigma there. And so we've got four Gentile women who are all forced into unsavory roles because of the hand dealt to them in life. And what's cool, actually, is God redeems their story, and now they're the lineage of the Messiah. That's kind of neat here. But is Matthew trying to make a point by including women? I think he would have been, otherwise he wouldn't have included them. And he picked them with care, because there are other women in the lineage too, right? About we already know the point of a genealogy is to make points, right? It's not just to record family history. Otherwise, every single generation would have been listed. He's making a point with this. And so the future of Jesus' life that's going to be described in this gospel has to do with what he's starting this off with and where they've come from. And so in this passage that we often want to skip because there's a list of names that are hard, there's a lesson about Jesus, I think, here. There's the throne of David that's getting fulfilled. Another thing might be, you might think that the Messiah is only for men or only for kings or only for people who have their act together. You're wrong. Who is this story for? Everybody, even people who are so oppressed that they have to literally play the prostitute, right? Like, Jesus' story is for everyone, for abused people, for people who have been given the short straw in life, for oppressed people, for men and for women. Jesus is for everybody. He's here to save everyone. God makes a promise to all people, not just one type of people, and not just Israelites, right? Because there's other people, these four women are all not Israelites in this. And the promise to make a lasting nation that will never end, will always be safe, and even the weapons of war are going to get to be used as kindling one day, that promise gets fulfilled in Jesus. And Jesus' promise is not just for men of the Jewish people. It's for everybody, every single type of person here. And so to wrap this up, I'm going to point out there's still one woman left in the genealogy that we haven't mentioned yet. Which woman is that? Mary. That's probably the most famous one, right? That's a big deal. And so the pattern of the genealogy makes a nice rhythm. It's the father of this guy, 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 the father of this guy. And then what finally breaks the pattern when it gets down to the end of it? It does not say in the last line, the father of Jesus. Instead, it says the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. And so then if you pretend you're reading the story for the first time ever and you don't know about the virgin birth yet, and you hear the father of, 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 the husband of. What are you going to ask? Who's the dad? Who is the father? And what's the answer? God. You get that in the very next verse if you read it, but then we're getting into more of the Christmas story. We're in the prelude to the Christmas story right now. And the very next verse, Joseph's not the father, but neither is any man. In fact, the woman who has Jesus is still a virgin when Jesus is born. There is no man who is a father. Jesus is the Son of God, and that is unique in a whole lot of ways. A whole lot of ways. He's a descendant of Abraham and David. He's the promise of faith for a lasting kingdom, and the government is upon his shoulders. And so now we know where God's people have been, hopefully. To get where you're going, you got to know where you've been. To know about the future, you got to know a little bit of the past. And hopefully now, a little bit of the past. There's a mess there. It's a broken people. It's women who've been abused. But God redeems it all and eventually makes good on his promises. And now Jesus has shown up. And now Jesus is here. And so now we can celebrate Christmas this year, hopefully with the knowledge that Jesus is a king forever. He is for all people, and he is the Son of God. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for even the passages in the Bible that we are tempted to say are boring, because we know that your word is living and active, and there are good things within, even more truths we can find the more times we turn to it. So God, help us not to just to glaze our eyes over a passage, but help us to see the cool things, like how Jesus is going to fulfill all the promises of a kingdom that will never end. And that Jesus is for everyone, men, women, children, all kinds of different types of people, all different types of walks of life. And so, God, we thank you for that. We thank you that your son Jesus came here for us. And so may we follow after him and be disciples of Jesus Christ. And we ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.